When it comes to investing, retirement, taxes, healthcare, and estate planning, the decisions you make today can greatly affect the quality of life for you and your loved ones tomorrow. What you need is straight and unbiased information on the most important issues you'll face when planning for your retirement and financial future. Good news! You found Premier Retirement Radio with Jeff Fogan. Jeff is the founder of Premier Retirement Planning and Wealth Management, and he's been guiding people financially and into retirement for 30 years. So get ready for an hour of the most comprehensive financial information on the radio. Premier Retirement with Jeff Fogan. And now here's Jeff Fogan and Jeff Shade.
Thank you so much. Welcome to Premier Retirement with Jeff Fogan, the radio show that gives you the straight talk and honest answers you need to help you reach your wealth management and retirement goals through smart investing and careful planning. I'm Jeff Shade, and I'm just here to ask the questions, of course, but the words of wisdom and solid advice, you know they come from Jeff Fogan, founder and president of Premier Retirement Planning and Wealth Management. Hey, Jeff, how are you doing this weekend?
Doing great. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you. Glad to be with you and, of course, all the fine people here of the greater Tucson area. Jeff, this is getting towards the end of April. May is upon us here. We are one-third of the way through this calendar year, and we're going to talk in this first segment a little bit about what's happening right now in the market and the economy and maybe do a little prognosticating about what's to come. First off, I'm reading a headline here that I saw this past week that says the sell-off in stocks since March was just the start and the correction has further to go as risks mount. So what do you think about this market pullback that we have had? Do you think it's going to continue, and especially during the presidential election season?
Well, I think, you know, as I mentioned before, stocks have been overvalued for a long time. And, you know, last year, the Fed did kind of a trick where they were pulling money out of the economy by selling bonds, having to raise rates in order to do that, which put a damper on not only the liquid money that was outstanding, but also, you know, raising rates puts, pressure on borrowing, which means tech companies and other companies typically get hurt. So, you know, in 2022, during that quick interest rate hikes, we saw the weakening of the stock market last year. You know, it had gone down 20 or 30% or so, and people were getting a little bit frustrated. And then the banks started going out of business, beginning of last year in 2023. And you can't really let the banks go out of business. They drive everything. I mean, the Fed, the central bank, and the Merrill Lynch's and the Bank of America's and the JP Morgan's of the world, they're all, you know, in cahoots with basically the money supply of, you know, America and, you know, largely the world. So again, you know, it's a pretty important thing to keep banks alive. So the government continued to raise rates. However, they were injecting cash to banks in order to prop the market up or to give them staying power. And I've seen estimates in between, you know, $2 and $4 trillion of stimulus from the standpoint of kind of like loans on their bad debt and loans because commercial debt was suffering after the COVID shutdowns and things like that. And, you know, banks were getting squeezed a little bit. So they basically had this new injection of capital, which they were able to do stock buybacks. And you saw the bank stocks went crazy last year, even though banks are not loaning money. We just had earnings a couple of weeks ago for the first quarter, and you know, they really didn't look that stellar, although bank stocks still seem to be propped up and continue to be fairly strong, even though they did have a small pullback. But it seems like the Fed, every time there happens to be a glitch in the market, they just find a way to inject money to the banks. The banks buy their own stock, for one. And, you know, for a while last year, they were buying NVIDIA, Microsoft, and, you know, propping up the biggest Magnificent Seven stocks in the S&P 500 and kind of helping that index go up, which got everybody else on board. You know, and then there was this AI hype. Oh, AI is the new thing. It's going to go crazy. You know, you got to get in. The Magnificent Seven stocks all had, a piece of that action. They were all going to get their own chips. You know, Tesla's going to have their own self-driving AI cars. Apple's getting in the mix. They're not anymore, but they were. Microsoft's going to make their own chip. Now they've got Intel doing it. You know, Google, Amazon, they're all going to do their own thing. And, you know, all the while, NVIDIA's getting all the action because they think every chip sold in AI is going to be theirs, while the other companies are getting a lot of traction as well. So they had this really kind of a faked out market. And as soon as it started running out of gas last year, they come up with this new idea that, oh, hey, we're not going to raise interest rates anymore. We're going to lower them. Well, lower interest rates are a great thing for the stock market, if especially tech companies. So in order to fuel that fire and to keep them going up, you know, you've got this idea that interest rates are going to go down or at least not go up anymore. By December, that little blip, which was a blip upwards, ran out of gas. And so then the Fed jumps in and says, in fact, we think we can lower interest rates next year. Isn't that going to be fun? And the market goes, yay, they're going to lower them. He says, up to 3 times. But, you know, all the while, you know, they think somehow inflation's getting under control when it really, as we know, inflation isn't getting under control. And, you know, we've got, you know, these promises that we're going to lower interest rates. But inflation, the mandate is to get it down around 2% before we can really consider ourselves in better shape. GDP, by the way, isn't very good. That's gross domestic product. The growth is, you know, in the 2-2.5 range, and, you know, popped up to 4 something, I think, for a minute. And then, you know, kind of lackluster considering, you know, healthy economies. So the Fed says they're going to lower rates 3 times. The market gets all excited. And then the banks come out right behind them and says, oh, we think there's going to be 5-7 rate decreases. And let's price them into the market now. You know, earnings were flat last year, but they price in all these interest rate decreases as if earnings next year are going to go up 25 or 30%. So what does the market go? It goes up 25 or 30%. And now we find out that that's a bunch of BS. And, you know, I don't want to take too much credit, but I was saying that since the beginning. Is like, I don't see how they're going to ever lower interest rates. It doesn't make sense to me. You know, if they do, it's just going to throw inflation up through the rafters again. And inflation is already still really bad. And they don't even like to count the numbers that include the inflation statistic that includes food and gas, even though that's the most important one. And everybody's paying double what they did for gas and double what they did for food, you know, when Biden took office. So, you know, Bidenomics is not working. Shrinkonomics is also part of that factor too. Why does that happen? Well, because companies are having a hard enough time keeping their own prices down. So we got this fake run-up that continued through the first of the year. But, you know, I think one of the things that we saw was some smart money said, wait a minute, inflation's not really getting under control. They're really not going to be able to lower interest rates. We're heading towards disaster. And then all of a sudden we see gold start getting hot, you know, and it's gone up, what, 15 or 20% in the last 6 or 8 weeks, made new highs. And the gold has been kind of flat for about 3 years. You know, they always say it's a hedge, it's a hedge, it's a hedge. Well, gold is something that smart money runs to. Banks are buying it. And, you know, even central banks of different countries around the world are buying it. And as a hedge, but typically it's a hedge when the dollar value falls or the interest rate falls. Because the U.S. dollar, for example, it's strong when interest rates are high. In fact, the U.S. dollar, everybody says, why the dollar's going to get weak, the dollar's going to get weak. Well, not as long as we're raising interest rates, especially if they're higher than they are around the world. Everybody's going to want to, you know, buy dollars that pay 5 or 6% in interest, not something else that like Japanese yen that pays close to zero. So again, our the value of our dollar's been propped up. You know, gold typically is a little bit counter to that. When the dollar's expensive, gold, you know, doesn't really thrive. But all of a sudden we see interest rates probably going to go up, yet gold goes up too, which was really counterintuitive. It had me scratching my head. But I think that just means the banks and the smart money know that there's probably recession type things imminent. In other words, we've kind of outbid the market prices of things. The banks largely been in control of the price of the market since Obama took office and basically took away a thing called price discovery. And I'll explain what that is. I could go into more detail, but basically, you know, when I was a broker 30 years ago, we did a lot of research on fundamentals to decide if a stock was worth buying or not. We charged commissions because we did a lot of research. We typically bought buy and hold things that had, you know, track records, and we're going to creep up as earnings crept up on those stocks. Now, you know, it's basically, hey, let's just print some money. We'll give it to the banks and let them buy whatever they want. And the market's going to go up and they can overpay because we'll just keep giving them money to fuel the fire. Fundamentals don't matter as much, but I'm old school. I have a really hard time with this because I still want to see stocks fairly valued. I still want to see stocks growing in some sort of a similar pattern as earnings. You know, if a company grows by 10% a year, I think the stock should grow by 10% a year, you know, based on its, you know, current value, if it's going to grow. But, you know, they've got 25 and 30% built in growth for the next year or so based on future earnings. And now we're getting these earnings reports coming out the first few weeks. Well, in April, it's basically they're finally coming in for the first quarter of the year. And while there's a few companies that are beating estimates, we're seeing earnings come in like at, you know, maybe 4 to 7% annualized, yet the market's going up 20 or 30% in 3 or 4 months. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Now, the thing that's getting the market excited, and it's really just manipulation and I think propaganda really, is when somebody gets on the news and says, oh my gosh, GM beat their earnings projections. They were only supposed to make X amount of dollars, let's say, you know, 60 cents and, you know, for the quarter, and they made 67 cents. Oh my gosh, they beat their earnings projections by 10%. Well, what does that equal? I mean, is that really a good thing? Or did they make 80 cents last year and this year at 67 just because they revised the earnings down and they beat the downward revised earnings? Is that really a good thing? Are we still getting growth? And, you know, I'm just throwing numbers out of my head. I don't even remember what GM's earnings were, but I think that was a surprise. You know, they come out and say, hey, we think we can make more profits. You know, they also say what they think they're going to do for the rest of the year. So they give what's called earnings guidance. They go, oh, we think we'll do better. Some companies, I think, are really honest. Say, hey, you know what? It looks like we've got a lot of competition and we're not going to do very well. I think, you know, Tesla's being honest. They're saying, gee, these, you know, China Chinese manufacturers, some of the other car companies, even the domestic car companies are making electric vehicles, and we're getting exposed here. You know, we don't see our profits being quite as robust as they were. We're going to have to lay off some people and, you know, make things happen. Well, Tesla's down 43%. Well, obviously so, because they were honest about their future earnings. But you get another company that says, hey, we think our earnings are going to be a little bit better. We're growing at 4%, but we think we can increase that. And so all of a sudden their stock goes up 5, 6, 7, 8, 10%, 20%. Like, well, that's kind of a disconnect. And so, you know, the earnings season is really kind of more of a marketing game, kind of a cheerleading game, kind of a hype game. You know, there are real numbers that impress. You know, when NVIDIA comes in with 100% earnings growth, two quarters in a row from a year ago, well, keep in mind that 2 years ago, the tech stocks were so beat up. They didn't have, nobody was buying anything and they didn't have a lot of earnings. So they really had a low bar to cross. And so the stock goes berserk. Now, you know, if it could stay at growing at that rate, I think that stock should be a $1,000 stock and double every couple of years. The fact is earnings can't grow by 100%. You can't keep doubling earnings on a year-over-year basis very long, especially with the competition coming in. So, you know, sometimes we get these little unrealistic reads when earnings do come in good or above expected, but incredibly good. But we have to keep them in perspective with what does that mean compared to prior earnings? Are they growing or are they shrinking? And is there competition that's, can they keep at this pace and so forth? So there still is some sort of a fundamental discussion, I think, that somebody has to have in their head is whether or not we're paying too much for, you know, stocks at this time. But, you know, it comes back to the government, Fed, central banks, and the commercial banks, which are technically the broker dealers out there, the biggest ones that manage all the money in the world, are kind of in cahoots propping this market up. So they're playing some games that give us a false sense of security. I think this sell-off that we had a couple weeks ago is significant. It does mean that people are aware that if rates don't come down, it's going to be harder for companies to make money. I think that's a realistic bet. I don't know if the government can really go back to printing money, you know, like it was. I mean, they're kind of sort of doing it in the back door right now, where they're not saying we're raising interest, but they're trying to sell bonds and they have to, in order to take money out of the economy, but they're having to raise interest rates to do so. And so we're seeing kind of an interest rate manipulation going on behind the scenes. It's not being publicized on the news, but I think interest rates are going to go up probably more likely over the next few months than go down. I don't know how much. I don't think it has room to go too much higher, just because I think people are going to feel that in the market. And the last thing that any election wants is a big market crash right before an election, because it kind of indicts the powers that be as being, you know, bad economic managers. Well, the fact is they are bad economic managers. Look at inflation. Look at unemployment is really higher than, you know, they're reporting. More than half the jobs they're creating are government jobs, basically paid for with taxpayers' money. That takes more fuel out of the government spending that could be, well, I don't like government spending anyway, but, you know, our taxpayer money could be used for a whole lot of other things than to creating fake jobs just to say, hey, we created jobs in the economy, great and robust, because those are typically low paying jobs and they're being replaced by high paying jobs. Companies like UPS dropped, what I think it was 10,000 workers over the last few quarters, and they come in with an earnings beat. Their revenues were down, but their earnings were higher. Why? Well, because they lowered their payroll. But did they really, you know, build their company in a place where they could continue to grow? Well, revenues are going down. So why does the stock go up? Oh, because earnings were up. There's always something that they can market, or a product or some buzzword that they can market to try to hype people that are no longer looking at fundamentals. Does that mean we should just go in with careless abandon and say, well, hey, you know what? They're not looking at fundamentals anymore. They're going to keep propping the market up. And we just trust the government to keep on fueling the fire and feeding the hungry animal because they'll never let it die. Well, I don't know. I mean, they have the power to feed it. They could probably have the power to unfeed it, or eventually the market's just going to say, sorry, no more. I can't take it, and do what it does. So I think we're in a really kind of a precarious position right now. We've overdone the market. We've overfed it. The government doesn't want it to crash before the election. They're doing everything to make it not crash. They're even manipulating, you know, interest rates. I think they're even trying to manipulate gold prices and not let them go up too much and say, hey, you know, this can't happen because, you know, we're really not going to have a recession. So there's a lot of things that are out there that I think, you know, need to be considered. Does that mean we shouldn't invest in the market? Well, I think when we get 5 or 6 or 7 or 8% on low risk or safe money, it's kind of a hard ask to go into a market that's already so overpriced that it could crash 20 to 50%, or it could make maybe another 5 or 10 before the end of the year. So, you know, I'm still, you know, more of a cautious person given the current status of what I think the economy really is, the current status of all the flags that say that we're probably going to end this cycle with a recession and a market correction much bigger than we've seen. I think this 10% correction a couple of weeks ago, it could be manipulated and kind of stayed. You know, we'll kind of see what the next week or two do. Typically after May, you know, the market kind of goes on kind of a hiatus historically because of the, you know, a lot of the traders and people go on vacations and schools out and all that kind of stuff. So You know, I think we might be kind of at the last phase of the upside. I don't know that it's ready to crash. I think if it does crash, I think they'll want it to happen. And I say crash, meaning more than like a 20% correction. We had, 10 or so just a week or so ago. And, you know, we had kind of a choppy market this week, mostly up, if I remember right. But, you know, we're at a point where we're going to kind of see what unfolds. If there is a recession, it'll probably happen, you know, before the next few months are up. As we get closer and closer to the election, I think they'll do everything they can to manipulate it. Even if they have to create more inflation by printing money, I think that they'll probably prop the market up between probably summertime and the election or the end of the year. But right now, I think we're still kind of in a choppy situation, and I think it should be looked at with caution. If you're a long-term investor, fine. If you're a short-term investor, if you need money to live on from the stocks, you know, I think there's better place to get a much more steady income, guaranteed and predictable income from, you know, fixed accounts that are safe and paying a high rate of interest like we didn't used to get. Now we're getting those again. So anyway, I don't know if that answered your entire question. I know I went in a big circle again, but, you know, that's my market take at the moment.
All right. Very good. Well, I do want to talk about something that you just talked about, and that is alternatives to the stock market and fixed accounts. But before we do that, Jeff, I want to remind people that if you're listening to the program today and Jeff's views resonate with you, you want the opportunity to sit down with Jeff and sort of pick his brain a little bit and get the questions answered that you need answered to put you on a path towards a confident retirement. Don't forget, we are offering no cost and no obligation Jeff's Premier Retirement Roadmap. It's a 5-point retirement review at no cost and no obligation. Jeff will cover an income plan, investments to support the income plan, also a tax plan, health care costs, and an estate plan. Those are the five pillars that he uses in these plans, and he'll review those for you. And of course, answer any questions that you have about the market and the economy, and maybe which direction that you should take. Once again, there's no cost, there is no obligation, certainly no judgment for this review. To get yours, you can do it right now. Call 520-780-9059. 520-780-9059. If you call this weekend, leave your name, your telephone number. Shelley will give you a call back during the week and schedule that appointment for you to sit down with Jeff. Once again, no cost, no obligation for this whatsoever. It's an opportunity for you to have a one-on-one conversation with Jeff, sort of your little private radio show, if you will. Once again, 520-780-9059. Give that number a call this weekend. You can also reach us or find out more about us online at premret.com. It's P-R-E-M-R-E-T. Jeff, I'm seeing an article that says investors are increasingly borrowing money to buy stocks. I mean, these investors certainly have confidence in the market. Consumer sentiment is high, but as you said, there are some alternatives to the stock market for those people who really want to stay out of that and want to err on the side of safety. And you were talking about some fixed accounts. Can you elaborate on those a little bit?
You know, bonds, bonds have gone, if you look at intermediate or long-term bonds, they've gone down about 20% over the last couple of years, and they haven't come back. They've tried to bounce a few times as, you know, the rumor came around that the interest rates might be being reduced by the Fed. And if that happens, bonds typically will go up. In other words, if you have a 5% bond right now and interest rates go down to 4%, that 5% bond is worth considerably more because, you know, you get more on it than somebody, than if you bought a new bond at 4%. So, you know, bonds go up, bonds go down. The bond market in general is down about 20. Some higher yielding bonds may be down even more than that over the last couple of years. The market's bounced back, but the bond market really hasn't. So, you know, a lot of people are frustrated because, you know, they show me a portfolio and go, well, how come the market's back and I'm not? Well, because half your money was in bonds that are still down 20. And, you know, over the last couple of years, the market's gone down and gone back up. And maybe it's up 6 or 8% net of January, February of 2022 on the market. So you're really still down maybe 8 or 10. Well, frustrating, right? Well, if you didn't have all your money in stocks and bonds and had some things in principal protected accounts like the LIRPs and FIAs, fixed index annuities that we use, you wouldn't have at least lost money. Yeah, I've had a couple of people come as like, hey, my index annuity went down the first year and it hasn't come back up. I'm barely up. I've only made a couple of percent in the last couple of years. But wait a minute. You know, you were in stocks and bonds when we met, and now you're actually ahead of the game. You weren't all in stocks and had to write it down 35% to come back 45% just to get even, and then who knows, lose it again in the next few months if the market corrects or crashes. I think we're definitely in a position where that could happen. I'm not going to, you know, wish for a crash or expect a crash. I mean, history says we should. Cycles do repeat. I'm certainly preparing for one by being defensive and cautious. So, you know, a few years ago, well, actually forever, we've been using principal protected accounts for our smart money. Now, if you go back to 2 years ago on some of these strategies, maybe we didn't make a whole lot of money in 2022, but we made money last year and we're largely ahead of the game. If worst case is we're even and we haven't, you know, our bond portfolio didn't drag us down. Right now, we can invest in bonds making, you know, more than most CDs and you know, short-term bonds are making, you know, over 5%. We've got short-term corporates that are making 6.5, 7. We've got some private equity available for our accredited investors that, you know, made 9.5 last year with very little risk, you know, just due to some private lending programs and things that are available to, you know, more sophisticated investors. They're almost principal protected. We've got LERPs. You know, two of our strategies 2 years ago in 2022 didn't lose any money, but one was up 9.5 last year and one was up 18.5 last year. So, you know, if you combine those to not lose any money and in a tax-free environment and a LERP in the last two, and I'll just compare the last 2 years because we had one good year, one bad year, right? And we don't know what's going ahead, but I don't mind a volatile market if we're not losing in the bad times and we can, you know, make money in the good times. So, you know, maybe you're up, you know, on average 5.5-6% over the last 2 years because you did something that was principal protected. And if you could have done it in a tax-free environment, either through a Roth with an indexed annuity that's up or a LERP, which is some of our most aggressive returns. Now, if you were lucky enough to be one of my new clients and got in beginning of last year when the market was low, we've got an indexed account. In fact, I've got one myself. I just looked at my statement. I'm up at 25% since February of last year. That's on an indexed annuity. It's a principal protected account. If I want to lock that in, I can lock that in and it'll stay right there at 25%, or I can hold out for more, or it'll automatically reset. There's different strategies that you can use for these particular indexes. And I can show you that paperwork. I mean, I'm not puffing this up. Now, some people say, oh man, I got mine 3 years ago. Well, when you got yours 3 years ago, interest rates were 1 or 2%. And you know, they're not able to leverage like they were a year ago when now the insurance companies that offer these products are making 4 or 5. Right now is an awesome time to have an insurance company make 4 or 5% on your money and leverage it and try to double or triple it if they can use that money to leverage on indexes in the market. In other words, if the market goes up, and some of you have seen that commercial on TV where it says, wouldn't it be great if there was an investment that goes up when the market goes up and when the market goes down, you don't lose anything? I mean, that product does exist. Now, I don't think the one that they're promoting there is it's kind of a watered down version of some of these more sophisticated products that, you know, we've been able to develop through some of our associate partners that have created some really creative, very leveraged, still very safe from the standpoint of principal protection, indexes that outperform over time just about anything, including in some cases, the stock market itself, because it doesn't have the downsides. So there are alternatives that right now are performing great, but our liquid money, the stuff that would otherwise be placed in the stocks and bonds, we've gone a little less aggressive because our indexed products can continue to be aggressive in the face of a surprisingly good market. And honestly, I was surprised last year that it made as much as it did. It didn't make sense to me. You know, little did I know the Fed was funneling money back door to the banks and they were investing in stocks and doing their own stock buybacks. And, you know, I was scratching my head to see what was really going on. It wasn't until about the first of this year when you see their annual reports and some of the stuff to know, oh, okay, this is how they made all their money. It was a lot of stock buybacks, a lot of their own stock. The Magnificent Seven largely drove the entire S&P 500, where 493 stocks were basically break even and only 7 stocks made the majority of all the gains of the entire market. So there was a lot of disconnect in my head from the standpoint of being all in the market or taking on that kind of risk. So we didn't. So we were making 5-9% on our safe money investments without having market risk and just kind of being the tortoise in the race on the liquid money. Now, there'll come a time I think the market will correct. It'll get down to sane values. Maybe after the election, which typically after the election, once we know who the president's going to be, is typically a good year. That might be a great time, especially if there's a correction and the market is priced lower than it is right now. It'd be a great entry point to go in and take a chance on making 10 or 20% in a rebound or a nice market year when it makes more sense. Meantime, if it surprises and we have a really good market year this year, then we've got the indexes and newer ones. I mean, granted, the newer ones are way better than the older ones. I know some of you are probably saying, well, yeah, but I've had mine for 5 years and they haven't done a whole lot. Well, you know, when interest rates are 1%, the insurance company might be able to get you 3 in a good year and 0 in a bad year. So that still averages 2 or 3, which is better than a CD would have got you if you bought it 5 years ago at 1%. But, you know, where the strength is in these principal protected products is really the newer ones that are based on much higher interest rates right now. And I don't know if higher interest rates are going to be maintained forever. They, you know, the Fed was saying they're going to lower interest. The banks were claiming they were going to lower interest. I think eventually it will. There will probably come a market sell-off. It will go into kind of a recessionary period where they have to lower interest rates just to kind of get the economy back on its feet again. So at that point, when interest rates are down again, I don't think purchasing new annuities is going to be as attractive as locking in the upside of higher interest rates now, because insurance companies invest your money These aren't Wall Street companies. Wall Street kind of hates annuities because they're kind of counterproductive to them. I mean, they don't invest in them. They don't offer them. So, you know, they don't like the fact that it's a competitive place for you to park some of the money that used to be in the market, maybe in your 401k or your IRA with, you know, your Merrill Lynch guy or Edward Jones guy or whoever. And, you know, now, of course, you're going to move something to something that, you know, they can't get paid on. Well, you get paid on it. You get market protection. It's crash proof and it's insured secured. And with these new indexes at higher interest rates, I think going forward, it's got a great chance to continue to produce more predictable returns, at least more predictable risk management, because you're not going to lose money on that money. And there's some alternatives that you know have been paying a lot better than even the fixed bond. So we're getting kind of the best of both worlds without having to take on virtually much risk at all right now. There are some clients that are longer term investors that have a growth portfolio that's been doing okay, but I mean, it's doing actually very well, but you know, it's got a lot of risk. I mean, I don't recommend it for anybody that's faint of heart or doesn't have money to lose, even if it is going up.
Jeff, hate to cut you off, but we're out of time for this particular segment. Once again, our telephone number, 520-780-9059. If you want to talk to Jeff and get your premier retirement roadmap. We're going to take a break, Jeff. When we come back, we've got listener questions and more when our show continues here on 790 KNST Tucson's Most Stimulating Talk.
You can't start a trip you've never taken without a plan. And you can't start your retirement journey without a comprehensive plan to get there safely. To request your no-cost Premier Retirement Roadmap, call 580-780-9059 or request it online at premret.com. Now back to more Premier Retirement with Jeff Hogan and Jeff Shea.
Thank you so much for joining us here every weekend for Premier Retirement on 790 KNST Tucson's Most Stimulating Talk. Of course, we're here for you about four times a week, Saturdays at 7 a.m., also 9 a.m. and 1 p.m., also on Sundays at 11 a.m. And as always, if you've missed any part of the program, remember, we're also a podcast. Go to wherever you get your podcast, search for Premier Retirement with Jeff Hogan. You'll find this show and many of our past shows so you can stay on top of your journey towards a prosperous retirement. And in this segment, Jeff, as always, we answer listener questions. This week will be no different. As I said, many people listen online. So we're going to take our first question from an online listener. Beth is joining us in the state of California. And Beth writes, how much money do you really need in retirement? What is the benchmark amount? What do you need to take into consideration? I'm about 5 years out, and my husband is about 2 years younger than me. What makes sense? Should I put a lot of money into saving for retirement now, or should I enjoy my life because you never know what's going to happen tomorrow? Do you try to defer taxes? We live in a high tax state, of course, California. Do we sell our house and get something smaller for the next 5 to 7 years before we probably move out of state? I don't know what makes sense. What's the right amount? When I see what it really takes to get to that dollar amount, it gets scary. And as always, Jeff, the answer is always, it depends.
Yeah. Oh, you're not going to save that one for me, huh?
Well, it depends. No, I want you to say it too.
It depends. Well, there's a lot here. You know, I don't know what high tax state. I know what big house means. I know California could be a tiny little house in Silicon Valley. It's a 3-bedroom for $2.5 million too. And
right.
You know, the thing is, you know, you might be listening on a podcast. I don't believe you heard the radio. I don't think our waves go that far, but probably for the podcast.
No, she's listening on the podcast probably, or awesome. she's getting the show off of the internet. But yeah, she's in the state of California where the max tax rate for the state is around 13.5% if you're a high earner.
Yeah, and that filters into sales of homes and things like that too. So right. I don't know if that's going to get any better. So I think you've said a lot of things that we need to address here. One is, you know, how much do you need in retirement? Well, it kind of depends on your, you know, where you plan to live. And if you do plan to move out of state, here to Arizona, it's a lot cheaper, obviously. It wouldn't be a bad idea, in my opinion, to consider taking advantage of the ultra high prices that California real estate's getting right now. There's kind of a shortage. I don't know if that's going to be the case. I think a lot of people are leaving the state, and there might cause a, you know, kind of a relief to the demand out there. And I don't know if that you're going to make as much on your home as you would if you just took the profits now and reinvested. Keep in mind, however, no matter when you sell on your personal property, you're going to have you know, a certain amount up to $500,000 is going to be tax free from the standpoint of capital gains. I don't know how much you've made on it, probably more than that, I'm guessing. But, you know, there will be some taxes to pay. There'll also be, if you move to a smaller house, if you have that Proposition 13 program out there, which I know about growing up in California and still having mom and a lot of relatives living out there. You know, if you move, you get a whole new state or real estate tax rate too. So if it's only for 5 years, you have to kind of do the math to see if that makes a little bit of sense. But as far as how much it takes to live in retirement, if you want to do a plan, and let's say you did divest of some of your assets, some of your maybe you can can move some of your 401k because you're 59 and a half. I don't know your age. I'm just guessing. If you're 5 years out, you're probably in the 60 range. And if you're like most people that kind of work till Medicare kicks in and they can, right. you know, afford to have the health insurance, but it could be different. You know, maybe you're 65 already and just want to work to 70. Whatever that is, you can set up, take some of those assets and put them into a guaranteed future pension plan, personal pension. I mentioned in the last segment about indexed annuities and LRPs. Those are the two assets that we use not only for principal protection, but also to create either guaranteed or predictable income and know what the taxes are going to be on those things, whether they be in pre-tax assets that create a guaranteed rate of return or a guaranteed income for life, regardless of whether or not that account outlasts the payments or not. If you die, you get the rest of the account to your spouse, your heirs. So it's kind of like a cake and eat it too annuity, not like the old pensions, not like Social Security, or not like, you know, the old annuities that, you know, give annuities a bad rap, where if you die early and don't get all your money back, the insurance company keeps it. Well, the insurance company, in those cases, insurance company or the Social Security trust fund or whatever, it keeps it for all those people that are going to live too long. So again, it's kind of just an actuarial averaged out situation that they figure those numbers out on. But there are personal pensions you can do with annuity companies that are principal protected, and you still keep access and control of the balance of that account through your life and after death. So those are some things you might want to, you know, consider. Those also will give you a guaranteed definitive number as a minimum guaranteed income. If you do it right now, you get 5 years of growth on that account. You know, you know what your income is going to be. If you keep it in the stock market or bond market, I don't know what it's going to be, because the stock market could be down 50% and then back up to even by then. Or maybe it could go up another 20% and then go down 30 and be below where it is right now. I don't know how people plan for retirement within 5 to 7 years of retiring with all their money in something that does not have a definitive number as to what that account's going to be worth when they retire. Everybody just takes a, well, what if the hypothetical, well, based on history, it should be this, should be. I don't want to base my retirement on should be, because that could be, you know, maybe a 20 or 30% chance that I miss my goals or that I don't have guaranteed lifetime income. I'd rather have it be as close to 100 as I can to know that at least my bills are going to get paid. So we take kind of a reverse engineering approach when you said, what's the number that we can live on? If we can guarantee a future income based on your Social Security projections, which are pretty close to guaranteed so far, they haven't made any changes or suggested any changes that would hurt that, other than the fact that in 10 years, the trust fund's going to be broken. We might have to make some sort of an adjustment down, or maybe just not have cost of living adjustments or raise taxes on everybody. I don't know. Whatever it is, we can probably count pretty close to Social Security to be what it is. And we can also guarantee other income sources with some of those assets. And let's just see what it generates. You know, I've had a lot of cases recently where people come in like, I just need $100,000 a year to live on. I know I can live on that. I know we're making $200,000 now, but, you know, we've got X number of IRAs. We've got this and that and the other. And, you know, I'm just scared of losing it because, you know I need at least $100,000. Well, between Social Security creating maybe 50 of it and another 50 having to come out of the other million or so in retirement assets, if you've got time and can invest maybe half of that savings into something that would guarantee another $50,000 in guaranteed income, you've got your 100. And then maybe you've got $600,000 or $700,000 left that you can use in interest-bearing accounts, or even maybe add a little bit more to guaranteed income and get your income up to $125,000 and still have a little bit extra nest egg for fun stuff, trips and things like that that you can invest. Maybe swing for the fences and try to hit some home runs with buying some growth stocks and using that kind of as your long-term, this is what I'm going to pass on to my kids as my inheritance money. All the while, you know, every month your bills are going to get paid. So we could reverse engineer this plan, just say, hey, what do you have and what is a realistic number? But more often than not, if we don't factor in losing money, in other words, if we take less risk with our money and have less in the stock market, even the bond market, we tend to come in higher than the people think they can live on. Because most people look at this 4% rule that Wall Street says, hey, just don't take more than 4% of your money out. Well, if you've got $1 million in savings, 4% is $40,000 a year. Well, if you're trying to get to 100 spendable and your Social Security is 50 between you and you got 40 more thousand, all of which is going to be taxable, I mean, you're only going to be spending 75 or 80,000, maybe. So you're going to be short. Well, how can you make some of that million create a higher income? Well, you can do it through guarantees that might pay a 6 or 7% payout. Why? Because when you don't lose money and you keep all the gains, and they lock in periodically, either annually, every other year, every 3 years, whatever, those locked in gains become principal. And if you spend down your assets, it will last longer when you're not losing money, because the market never has those negative years. Volatility is not a part of the picture. You know, it doesn't make sense that Wall Street says the 4% rule is a safe amount of money to take out of your accounts in retirement when the stock market averages 10 over the long haul and the bond market averages 4 to 6 over the long haul, depending on what stat you want to use. So why is it that you can take out less than either of those average returns? And that is fact is, it's an indictment on the risk policy of retirement planning for income. It's a fallacy. It's a joke. It doesn't work. It's great for building assets because those average rates of return are high, and volatility actually helps when you're adding money to your accounts every month or every paycheck or every year with a IRA contribution or whatever. But when you're taking money out, it's counterproductive. So you need to look at how to structure those assets to where they'll create the income you want. How much income is a reasonable number? Keeping enough in liquid accounts for emergencies and other things, and then saying, hey, can I live on that? Or do I have to work 7 or 8 years instead of 4 or 5 years? That might be where you want to start. And we'd be happy to work with you. We do a lot of Zoom meetings with out-of-state clients. And you know, like I said, I've got family and friends and some clients in California. So it's not like a new thing that I wouldn't understand what you're going through, especially if you're going to move to Arizona eventually anyway. Right. Then we can start that relationship early if you'd like.
Beth, thank you so much for listening to us online, whether it's on the stream or the podcast. We appreciate that. And of course, we'll send you out Jeff's book, Retirement, The Road Ahead. Next question, Jeff, is Richard in Reed Ranch. And Richard says, I'm 67, married, and I've just retired. I was previously planning on tapping home equity in the event of a long-term care event. I think my wife would be more comfortable if we had long-term care insurance. So I'm leaning towards a hybrid policy, but I'm trying to figure out the best way to pay for it. Is there a way to fund this from a pre-tax account that would minimize taxes?
Not really. Anything that has sort of a life benefit or a health benefit or long-term care benefit kind of has to be paid with after-tax money, at least the way that I lean towards them. I am definitely a fan of hybrid policies, or I wouldn't call them hybrid. I kind of call them the asset-based policies where you plunk a certain amount of money into an account. And, you know, if you die, it's worth double or triple what you put in. If you go to a nursing home, it's worth double or triple of what you put in. If you end up needing the money, you can just pull it out and live on it. That's honestly what we use LIRPs for, life insurance retirement plans. Now, the fact that they're tax-free may give you maybe a reason to think a little bit differently, just as you're thinking how your wife would rather be comfortable having a long-term care sort of an insurance plan instead of, you know, relying on the house. And I get that. I mean, what if she's living, has great health, and you're still living in the house and you end up using all the equity line of credit for your long-term care and she's stuck there with a big old bill when you die? And you know, I can understand why she'd be a little bit more concerned. Women typically outlive men, so that's probably why she's a little bit more conscious of this than maybe you were at first. But think of that. In her perspective, that could be, you know, leaving her hanging, and you're not there to help. So I think the long-term care hybrid policy, or what I would call the asset-based policy, makes a lot of sense. However, I believe that because it comes out tax-free and you'd rather use those assets as tax-free income or even a tax-free death benefit, I would say consider just looking at the math on paying taxes now. While taxes are probably lower than they will be in the future, you'll be paying tax on less money and likely taking out more money from that asset tax-free. So, you know, if you did it on a pre-tax account, you would make it less costly tax-wise now, but it may be taxable later, especially if you don't use it for long-term care. Now, I know if you pull it out for long-term care, you might get an offsetting tax deduction for the healthcare costs that that are associated with that. Right now, that's the way the rule works. We don't know if that's going to be the case in the future, but, you know, I would assume that it probably will be. What if you have more in assets there, or maybe you need some of those to live on and some of those to pay for the long-term care? If they're all tax-free, you could still write off that care against Social Security income, annuity income, IRA income, and other income sources. So you still get the best of the benefits, which is the tax write-off in the future, but then you get extra tax-free income should you need it, either before you go to a nursing home, just to enhance your lifestyle in retirement, and leave a nice little death benefit for the heirs of what's left in that type of a life insurance retirement plan. The acronym is LIRP, Life Insurance Retirement Plan. We use life insurance, but that does double for long-term care. That asset is available to you. It's a death benefit, but if you want to spend the death benefit during your life, that's when I think it truly becomes life insurance. Long-term care insurance. You don't have to die to get a death benefit. Most of these companies have what's called accelerated death benefits, which means you can take them early. You can spend them early on things that you need during your life that actually can help you during your life. Rich people use it all the time in lieu of Roth IRAs because they can put a boatload of money in it. They don't have to wait to 59 and a half to take money out tax-free or without penalty. They don't have to wait 5 years to take money out tax-free if they don't want to. So big dollar people, rich people, you know, even institution. I think banks probably own more LIRP type investments than they do their own CDs. You know, big firms, hedge funds typically load up on this because it's a tax-free product, and wealthy people have used it forever, but it's not outlawed for normal people, middle-class people, or people just trying to get by to use what the rich people use. You can use it too. I mean, take advantage of the safety features, take advantage of the ability to grab that death benefit during your life, spend it, use it, not be taxed on it, and pay for your long-term care should that come up. So now, just like long-term care insurance is going to be based on your health, you have to be healthy enough to get it. You do have to be healthy enough to get any version of healthcare planning. So, you know, if you end up where the underwriting doesn't come out favorable, then you might be back to, okay, how do I make this home equity line of credit or a reverse mortgage or something like that be my backup plan? And that might end up being the final plan. Again, depending on your ability to be underwritten, your health, age, things like that are going to have to take into consideration.
Once again, Richard, we appreciate you listening to us in Reedy Ranch, and your book, Retirement, the Road Ahead, is on its way to you. Final question this week, Jeff, comes from Howard, who's listening to us in Oro Valley. Howard writes, I would be interested in having you talk in your radio show about using an irrevocable trust as a beneficiary for an IRA or 401k. I know there are issues with losing some of the tax benefits unless the trust is set up correctly, but I really don't know what to ask or look for when I go and get a trust set up. What are some of the pros and cons of using a trust as a beneficiary?
Well, the first thing I need to know is, what are your goals? Why are you even considering this trust? Now, irrevocable usually means unchangeable. Now, I do use a version of irrevocable trusts in the context of charitable remainder trust. You know, I've got a few clients that have huge amounts of money and, you know, stocks that have gone up, like, you know, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, and that kind of thing, and, you know, have millions and millions of dollars into stocks, or they've got a little apartment complex that went berserk in, you know, value, and all of a sudden now they have this big estate tax problem. And in the context of IRA or 401k that you're talking about, that's a huge tax burden to your heirs. If you have one child, for example, and you've got $10 million in that IRA, they're going to have to either pull it all out at once or pull it out over 10 years. What if you have a child and a bunch of grandchildren that you could leave it in a charitable remainder trust? Guess what? That is an irrevocable trust. That's a version of it. You would actually get out of any estate taxes when the money goes there. You only have to leave the charity about 10% of the actual value, and you could create an income stream up to about 40 years. I think the longest we went was about 40 years, you know, two generations deep, kids and grandkids, of a payout, which ended up being a lot more net income and a lot less taxes. And because you're leaving at least a residual amount to charity, then you'd skip most or all of the estate taxes, which is a 40% rate right now, and a lot of the income taxes, and your heirs would not be expected to pay tax at the highest possible ordinary income tax rate because they'd be able to take it out over a period of time. Now, I would imagine that if you gave, you know, all your money to one child and that child had kids, they'd split it up amongst their kids too. And so it would basically be divided up amongst several portions anyway. Why not just do that out of the trust and keep everybody in a lower tax bracket than they would be if just one person got it, paid all the taxes, and then tried to spend it out? So that's one version of irrevocable trust. Often we use irrevocable trust as a place to buy a life insurance policy. We call it an ILIT, an irrevocable life insurance trust. The reason we would do that is we would take the money out, pay taxes on it now, stick it in, and it would basically be an estate tax freezing technique where you would move all, which would be all the assets or much of the assets that would be future, have an estate tax liability into a trust that's now counted outside of your estate. Now, typically, we would do that out of after-tax money, not IRA or 401k money, because you'd have to pay tax on the way out. Again, if you do the math and project into the future, say, what would be the cheapest tax burden on me? Pay tax now on moving the IRA or 401k, paying taxes now instead of later, and leaving a huge chunk of money estate tax-free and income tax-free to my heirs, even though it would be less immediate dollars right now, should I move that money? If that math makes sense, then consider that. As far as just putting an IRA or 401k into a trust as a beneficiary, if you have kids that you think are irresponsible with money, or maybe one's really good at it and one really isn't, you know, I have some clients, I had an autistic daughter that passed away, and because my affiliation with the Autism Society and other charities and things like that that deal with autism, I have a lot of clients that have autistic children. I guess, you know, birds of a feather flock together, they say. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are times when you'd want maybe big brother, who's very, you know, lucid when it comes to money, even though autistic little sister is perhaps functioning and doing well, just doesn't understand money. Maybe you want to leave your IRA or 401k into a trust. It doesn't have to be irrevocable in that case, but you leave it in trust so that somebody can be the trustee for the benefit of that other person that's maybe not very good with money. Or maybe somebody's just a spendaholic and doesn't know how to manage it, period. Or maybe they've had a drug problem in the past and you don't want to give them a temptation to get involved in that again. So you want to, you know, set things up in trust where a trustee can manage those for you. It doesn't have to be irrevocable. If that's all you're trying to get at, you just have to trust the people you're putting in charge. And it could be one of your children. It could be a friend, family, even a trust company. I don't recommend that. They're typically expensive, and I don't think they really keep your values in mind over and above their own many times. So I would try to find somebody close to the family, close to those that you're trying to protect, that would have a vested interest in caring for them and less cost. So I kind of went a little bit further beyond the irrevocable trust, why somebody would use it. But I kind of think I would want to know, in order to give a better answer to this question, is what you're trying to accomplish. You just heard it was a good idea. Well, why? Why is it a good idea? Oh, I don't know, because somebody did it and he's a rich guy. Okay, well, maybe he has a different problem than you. And maybe it doesn't have any effect on your estate because it's totally different than the other guy. So, I find that to be the case a lot of times. Somebody say, well, I golf with a guy that does this. And, they'll just make these half-cocked comments while they're hitting balls. And then they'll come in and think, oh, well, that guy is more successful than me, I think, because he drives a nicer car away from the golf course. So I think I want to do what he does. And I want to do this. Well, why? Does it really have a bearing on your situation? Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. So, everybody's situation is different. Tax benefits definitely do have to be considered when you set up a trust. Make sure you're doing it for the right reasons. For example, you can't leave yourself on as a trustee of an irrevocable trust. That's not arm's length transactions. When you die, irrevocable trusts about 60 or 70% of the time get audited. You don't want that flag to come up and say, oh, well, this is a grantor retained right trust, meaning you could choose the trustee, but you chose yourself. That's not a good thing. You exempt yourself from some of the tax benefits. So yeah, you do have to set them up right. There's all kinds of hurdles that you have to go over, but first we need to know why you want to do it and probably pick the best, quickest and easy way to get from point A to point B.
Howard, thanks so much for that question. And of course, we want to thank Richard and Beth for sending us those questions as well too. And again, if we didn't answer your question completely, you can give us a call here at the office to talk to Jeff, 520-780-9059. By the way, if you do have a question for us that you'd like us to answer on the air, you can get it to us by calling it in to Shelley, 520-780-9059. Or better yet, go to the website, premret.com, premret.com, and ask for it there. And of course, if we do use your question on the air, we will send you out Jeff's book, Retirement, The Road Ahead. Once again, I want to remind our listeners that if you have some questions of Jeff, maybe you'd like an opportunity to sit down with him on a one-on-one, very personal basis and ask your individual questions to get the answers that you need to figure out this retirement journey. Retirement planning is not necessarily a very simple thing. It can be complex, but, take this off your shoulders and put it on Jeff's shoulders to figure it all out. To get your plan, call 520-780-9059. Now remember, it's not going to cost you anything. 520-780-9059. Why not make that call this weekend? 520-780-9059. Leave your name and telephone number. Shelley will call you back during the week so that you can set up an appointment with Jeff to have that conversation. No cost, no obligation, no judgment. 520-780-9059 or online at premret.com. That's premret.com. Jeff, we're running out of time for this week. We have a short period of time left, so I'm going to throw out this blanket question for you. If someone comes into you and says, Jeff, I want to retire. I'd like to do it right now, but I'm worried about the market. I'm worried about the economy. I'm worried about this presidential election that's going to happen. Can I afford to retire now, or would I be better off just to wait until the election is over?
Well, can you afford to retire now is really an irrelevant question. There's always going to be something that is looming in the background. I mean, if you're worried about the election, or you're worried about the price of gas or the price of rice in China, or the conflicts in the Middle East, or how much money the government's given to Ukraine instead of paying for our own border security, there's always something that you're going to worry about. If that's the case, then don't plan on retiring at all. And I don't mean to sound cynical, but seriously, your money has to do with how much you've saved. Now, here's the deal. If you're going to keep yourself invested in the market, because right now it looks like the government's doing everything to prop the market up, and you want to wait till after the election to retire because you think you can make more money in the market, you have a good chance of losing money in the market too. What if you lost 50%? Well, then you'd be retiring not next year, probably 5 or 10 years down the road, because you have to kind of wait till the market, healed up. It might take a little quicker than that. It might take longer. I don't know. So bottom line is, if you secure your retirement by reducing your risk and creating income streams that you can count on that are either guaranteed or at least predictable, and you know what your taxes are going to be, and then you have enough that is left over that you could afford to ride out a market crash or ride out a new president or ride out a weird election season or whatever. If you have only the money at risk that you can afford to lose or wait on, and you can do with the rest everything you need to fulfill your retirement dreams with an income you can count on, then you can retire when that time happens. I've helped a lot of people see. Shoot, I showed one guy. He was going to get about a $20,000 a year pay raise when he retired in 5 years. But when we looked at it, his retirement had already capped out. Everything was capped out. And I said, you know what? The only thing you're going to lose by retiring right now is maybe a couple hundred dollars a month in Social Security benefit. I said, you can have an $18,000 raise if you retire right now, or you can keep where you're at and wait 5 years and have a $20,000 a year raise later. So it's only going to go up about 10%. Does that make sense? Man, I take the extra 5 years at $18,000 a year. in benefit. It was hard for him to see the math, but when he did, he goes, yeah, I'm going to retire. And well, and then they talked him into staying at least one more year. Come on, just stay one more year, please. We can't do without you. We need to find a replacement, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, but that was, you know, one of those, you know, happy days. Like, hey, sometimes you can retire a little earlier than you think because you're actually in better shape than you are. So, you know, just look at the whole picture. I don't think the election or any other current event is should make a difference on whether you retire. It really depends on, you know, what happens to your money in the meantime. Right now is a great time to lock in profits. The market's back up where it was a couple of years ago. The bond market's still down. Maybe you're still down a little bit, but if we don't lose any more money or take in the shorts if the market corrects and it shows that you're okay to retire now or next year, then let's make those adjustments and make sure you don't lose any money so that you can have confidence to retire, whether it's before or after the election.
Well, Jeff, the clock is ticking here, and unfortunately, we're out of time for this week. Once again, I want to remind our listeners that if you'd like to sit down with Jeff, have that confidential private conversation, 520-780-9059, no cost for that at all, and no obligation, 520-780-9059. Jeff, I want to thank you for your time, but most of all, I want to thank our listeners for joining us here in the greater Tucson area and also our online listeners in California. For Jeff Ogan, I'm Jeff Shade. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you again next week with another edition of Premier Retirement right here on 790 KNST, Tucson's most stimulating talk.
Investment advisory services provided through Premier Wealth Advisors, LLC, an Arizona State Registered Investment Advisor. Securities transactions are placed through TD Ameritrade. Insurance and annuity products are offered through Premier Advantage, Inc., DBA Premier Retirement Planning and Wealth Management. Investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Any reference to protection, safety, or lifetime income generally refer to fixed insurance products. Insurance guarantees are backed by the financial strength and claims paying abilities of the insurance carrier. The show is intended for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as advice or recommendations. Due to show format, accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. Premier Retirement and its representatives do not provide legal or tax advice and may only conduct business with residents of states and jurisdictions where they're properly registered.